offended. Personally, I think they were laid on the bottom when they put them in originally, and I think that sediment that was under them migrated out and left them suspended. So now you're asking, well, do if we're going to go spend, you know, if we the whole crossing might be 12, 15 million, do we look at a new pathway that's lower risk, might be longer? So there's some geological issues that we need to also investigate. That's why I'm saying that it's more than likely it's going to be longer than people would like. But we also want to make the right decision and provide you guys with the right information to make that decision. And Robert, did you have...
I did, and one of the goals of having the E-Track people look at these underwater side scans is to determine whether or not there's been some subsidence or some movement or underwater, you know,
slide or something.
Something, some activity there. So is there any evidence there's been something recent? Is there a slide that's caused by these, I don't know, an earthquake that we didn't care of, that we didn't see? So, or I don't know. What did they find when they looked there?
So one of the first things we did out of the gate is like, was there a seismic event recently, right? And well, that particular day, and there wasn't of significance within a few miles. There were some 40, 50 miles away, but that's not that doesn't mean that something, a seismic event, didn't happen a week or two or a month before that actually caused something. We don't know that level of detail yet, and some of the the additional tests we may do will hopefully give a little bit more definition to that bluff and maybe get closer, so you could maybe see if there was some sloughing off that side. Might also go down with some type of ROV and see if you can put eyes on it as well, because that would give you some visual indication of that. Currently, in direct answer to your question, we have not seen anything yet or have been able to record anything that would show that. But I think some of our testing was fairly high level, the initial stuff. And now we're probably going to get down, we know the specific area where it's at, and really get down into the granularity of root cause if we can. And if it's buried under 15, 20 feet of debris, we may not even know. That's the challenging part, unfortunately.
I have some familiarity with that area near the King River. And, you know, there's some huge accretions that have occurred since the last time, you know, with 1928, I think, was there really when they did it, really some close examinations of the water depths. And some of those depths are, you know, 50, 60 feet different now than what they were then.
So. I would believe it. And don't forget, GCI had a cable failure very near to our location here a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. And there's some history that goes way back where there were some other failures in that area as well. So it's not unheard of in that area.
Have they shared? I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Did they share with you what the root cause of their failure was?
We did get some information from them on a report, from what I can deduct out of it, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Clay, it was some sediment built movement. Their cables are a lot smaller than ours, so, you know, envision if you had a cable that was stuck in the middle of 10 or 15 feet of sediment, and that sediment flow started to move, and it was a less robust cable, I could see that easily dragging and just breaking the cable and putting it under heavy tension. We don't know at this point if that's something that's occurred with ours or not. We haven't got to that point yet.
So part of the monies that we're asking for is to further research that. We also, the University of Alaska has loaned us a underwater drone that's capable of going to 600 feet. So some of that we could do in-house, just to go down there and get video footage of that area now that we know where the location is. But then I mentioned earlier, you can, there is a geologist that we have in mind as well, an underwater geologist that we're looking at seeing about getting involved so that he can look at some of the footage, look at some of the data that we got from E-Track, because E-Track's not, they're not geologists. They just get the information. Now we need to get an interpretation.
Yeah.
I just have a very basic question. There's four cables making this crossing. One of them is faulted. One's an extra. How come there's four cables? What do they do?
So three-phase power. So each one's carrying a phase of power, and then you have one spare. And then the one that failed, we just moved the other one over and took the place of that other phase of power.
Briefly explain phase of power.
You want me to do it?
Yeah, sure.
Briefly.
All right, I'll do it really quick. So our generators, can I use this for?
Sure.
Not mine, go ahead.
All right, as long as it's not a permanent marker. Basically, our generators, they are sitting here with a bunch of wires on the outside of them. Let's just put three of them. And in the middle, we have magnets. So when you take a magnet and you move it by another magnet, you can kind of feel that force. Or if you take a magnet field and you put it by a piece of copper, it induces a current or a voltage. So in order to spin this thing in a circle, we have basically the waterfall that hits a propeller like on your boat, and it spins this magnet. By increasing or decreasing that magnetic field, you change the voltage and you change the amount of induced current in this. These right here, each one of these wires, you do it with three wires because you can wrap them around the unit equally, and you can have equal distribution of magnetic forces. So each one of these wires go out on a power line, right? And they all come out, and then so you have three power lines. So your house at home, whether you stepped it up or voltage up or down, and you're changing the pressure in the pipe for what part of the town you're in, your home might be connected to this wire. Some other person might be connected to this wire, and that's kind of what Andy's job is, to try and balance that. How many homes are in each wire, so that when it comes back to here, we have a balanced system. So that's why when we add new customers, we add customers in that fashion. We try not to overload one cable versus another. But that's basically what it is. I mean, you have a magnet that spins, and it creates electrons. It moves the electrons along the wires, and the three phases is what he's talking about. And they're on that first page, you saw a waveform like this. And that's because the voltage is increasing and decreasing. Because this magnet has a north and south pole to it. You know, if you took magnets, flip them apart, they'd oppose each other. But then you brought them together, they'd come together. So north and south poles, north, you know, is attracted to south pole. So I'm going to magnetic flux and all, but that's a real generalized view of it.
But a typical house is single phase, and industrial applications like the shipyard would be three phase or the fish plants.
So like this building's three phase, and the reason why you would add more phases to it. So each one of these phases is, for example, well, let's just go to your house. You have 120 volts in your house. Your 120 volt waveform looks like this. On one of the other lines above, running over on the street, you see how there's three wires. If you were to bring a different line in your house and drop it down to 120 volts, it would be offset just a little bit by 120 degrees. Well, that offset causes a greater voltage between the two. So it would actually, instead of being 120 volts, you would have a wall. If you have two different wires coming in and you put your voltmeter there, it'd be 208 volts. So it'd be a higher voltage. And the higher the voltage you step up, the less the current, the less size wire it takes to move the same amount of energy, to move the motor or to turn on an oven or whatever. That's why your ovens are 208. Actually, they're usually, if you're a single phase drop, they'll actually, we'll just have a 110, 220, but we have 220 volts. But if you hear 208, that's because it's phase to phase. You have two different parts of that generator being introduced in your home.
So as part of the practice too, you guys rotated those every now and then to keep them.
Yep. As far as the spare, moving it into service and moving one of the other legs out.
Yep. Chair. Trey, if all hell breaks loose and we lose another cable, what's the fastest we can effect a repair, a temporary or permanent, to ensure the lights stay on in Petersburg?
So when we interviewed potential consultants, we had some of those conversations. I'll say that it varies a bit, and I'll be able to answer that question better when I know how deep the cable is. Because if it's too deep and we can't affect a repair on it, then we'd have to order an all new cable, and that would most likely come out of South Korea, Japan, or something like that, and move up a larger boat, and so the logistics and stuff would take longer.
And there's no ability to do a temporary lay of something that's less armored, less whatever, just on a temporary basis to get us through the year that it takes us to get the... And again, I'm looking at catastrophic, all hell breaks loose. There's no temporary fix that we can do, bring in from somewhere that we do it.
The temporary fix would probably be a repair.
But let's say...
Because half the cost is the mob cost, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot. So if you're going to mob the boat, and even to take it a little step further, depending on your repair process. So if you're going to make a repair to the existing cable, there might be a boat in the Northwest that we could use to do that. If we're going to lay a brand new cable, that you would probably put that burden on the cable maker and the contractor to bring that cable over on a special ship and then have the ship lay it. Take that even one step further. If you go to the three conductor is a lot heavier, and it takes a bigger boat to do that. So it really matters the mechanism that you're trying to repair at.
I imagine a three conductor would also involve some station upgrade on your land base side.
Any dry type's going to, yes.
Yeah, clearly. We'll have to re-engineer the landing spots.
Yeah, I wanted to go along with Steve. That was my question. What changes would we have to make then on the land side if we went to the three conductors versus that?
That would have to be re-engineered. I mean, the liquid-filled portion of it would have to be eliminated. You could bypass that, and then the landings would be different. And then, obviously, the alarming and controls and all that stuff would be different as well. So there's some challenges there. And then on top of this, we haven't even talked about it all, is there's a permitting element. So that's to characterize where we're at today. We've kind of done triage, and so those are some of the next step details that we were working with our consultant to identify a permitting plan and start down that process. The repairs will take a certain level of permitting. Replacement will take a lot higher level of permitting, and then on top of that, are we going to do the same routing? So, you know, the design, the routing, all plays into the permitting process. So all of these kind of have to converge in order to do it.
There is, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No,
is there a possibility that we have to do some sort of a full environmental impact statement for a brand new cable lay?
If it's in a different route, that's possible. I don't know the answer to that yet, but I would say it certainly is a possibility.
Lisa, and then.
So I know there are several layers, different agency permits involved. I can't even imagine what all of those are, but part of it is Corps of Engineers. Is this considered a structure in navigable waters? Do we have to do the maintenance if we're able to do a repair? That should be covered under nationwide, I would think. I would hope.
That's going to be the next step, to identify what permits are required
If I could, just in the project I was involved in, we did set it up in a more favorable way to take advantage of the nationwide permitting. So I think there's a way to
on a repair, obviously.
Well, but it was both a repair and a replacement.
Oh, outstanding. Okay.
So it was having to pull the cable out and replace it. I have some pictures I can show you at lunch about the difference, but cables. But yeah, that's a key question about how we structure it.
Bob?
Well, I was wanting to follow up to Lisa's. From your experience right now, what all permitting, just from your current experience, Corps of Engineers, who else in the state would we have to?
I'm not prepared to answer that in any detail quite yet. That's, like I say, that's kind of the next step after this triage, to get headlong into the permit, figure out the permitting plan. I mean, if you might have NIMS issues, I mean, there's a whole gamut, and I really need somebody that is focused on the expertise.
And
the
tribal. Back whale issues now coming.
Consultations. So, just an encouragement to be working closely with Petersburg to ensure that they're prepared to be on diesels if that comes about. And then community-wide, I think we should, you know, we're putting together a cat in the box that we may have available if there was an emergency in Petersburg that we could send over to you. I think we need to all rally and make sure that the community is protected. It's very worrisome.
Yeah, it's got me bothered, yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I will note that I have been copying the Petersburg mayor on our updates, too, and keeping him in the loop.
Perfect. No, that's I wasn't saying you weren't. I just really encourage folks to be aware.
Yes,
Mr. Lisa. Chair, I have something I'd like to talk about that's more of an administrative function related to the agenda statement itself. When everybody's done asking questions about the project.
Okay.
One more question about, there are three phases right now going to Petersburg, I mean, going back and forth, whatever. If one of the cables did drop out, it was two, there'd be two left?
Correct.
But going to Petersburg, does that mean that they lose a third of their power, or all of their power?
All of their power.
I guess I don't understand that. Why is that?
Because if I don't, remember how I said we have to balance by the house?
Yeah.
If I lose a whole phase, that generator is going to be off balance. It'd be like, instead of having a nice three-phase magnetic field on it, it's going to be like two of them. And so it can't run like that. It'll just trip offline.
Any other questions in regards to the moving ahead with this? I think that the more testing is necessary to make sure that we get the best understanding that we can about the ability to repair it. I think in the long term, I think we need to think about full replacement. We have some suspension. This cable isn't made to be suspended. And I think that's a larger discussion. And this is just one of our crossings. We have many more. And some of the other crossings have even more suspension on them. And so as we go through this process, we have to, I don't know what our total liability for all the cables are, but it's huge. It's huge. And they are, what, how old now?
35, 40 years old.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, is it possible to move the cable? Like, is it possible to take a cable that's exposed and shift it? That's my first question. My second question would be, if we laid a subsequent cable, is it possible to put a loop in so you have some room to have it, if it pulls out, that it actually takes that loop and uses that sort of as a cushion?
So the last question, yes, you can put a U-shape into it. Now, oftentimes when you make a repair, you end up with a bit of a U-loop in it. So there's ability to put some excess in. You know, and you think it's a 3 mile long loop, I mean, you can certainly loop it over. So you can do that. And the first question, I'm not sure I got that one.
So you have these suspensions. Is it possible once you can bring the ship in and shift the cable to remove suspensions?
So when we discovered that initially, we actually considered some of the options. And one of the options there would be to disconnect at the shore, let out some of the cable to relieve it, to get it sitting back down on the bottom, and you'd have to splice on a piece. That would have, first of all, would move it off the part that's already sitting on the rocks. And there is some evidence of what we call strumming. You can see it in some of the bottom depictions that we've got, where you can see it going like this in the bud on the bottom. And of course, when you got that 1,000 foot plus span out there going like that, that part where it goes over the rocks up here, sitting there grinding on that a little bit, right? But that is not without risk. You know, they're still working fine. There's no indication that the armor's worn through. There's no twigs poinking out of it like you would see if one had broken off, right? Like a fray on a cable or something. We're not seeing that. So if you did try to let that down off to the bottom, It is a consideration, and it will probably be one of our options that we'll identify, but it's not without risk, and it's going to require an expensive and complicated splice. And anytime you do a splice, there's a risk that the splice won't work or won't last long. That's always a risk.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Cliff. Obviously, this is going to be an expensive fix, whatever ops we look at doing. Is there anything like an energy grant that we can tap into for updated technology? This is 35 years old, and like Robert said, you have a potential environmental risk with that lead laner in there. You play that card at all?
I've seen nothing in that area that would allow us to. And there are still a lot of fluid-filled cables around the world. And in the U.S. Tons. Still, so
they still manufacture them, just not with the lead sheet.
Oh, okay, yeah. So, I wish. Yeah. Good question. Though.
All right. Any other stuff about the undersea? And you have some videos at lunchtime, right?
We do.
We have a lunch and learn.
We do.
So we do have a motion in order to. Oh, and you want to?
I just have a sort of a agenda statement.
Sure.
Question. So this is a little bit related, Trey, to the comment that Steve brought up earlier about where we are. Are we butting up against the money we have in the R&R fund? Is it possible for you guys to add a fiscal note to the agenda statements where there's money involved that says what account it's coming out of or what fund it's coming out of and what the unencumbered balance of that account or fund is? Is that something that would be difficult? That way we know there's still $750,000 remaining unencumbered in that account or in that fund.
Right.
And you don't have to maybe not answer that right now, but just something.
I'm just thinking of how we do that and in what cases would we do that. Potentially, I guess, things that were outside of the normal budget. I'm presuming that's what you're getting at. Let me ponder that. I mean, normally, under normal circumstances, special meeting, of course, normally we'd have all the financials
right
in front of us, and you'd see the balances of in the R&R and in the full budget and where we're at in the budget.
Even still, if mm-hmm. I'm looking at an agenda statement, I got to flip back and go through 17 pages of financials to figure out.
Right.
That's a little bit.
And you're wanting that in the agenda itself?
So
is that correct?
You have a box here that says suggested motion. If you guys added a box to your agenda statements with fiscal note in it that just says the account or the fund, and there's, we're going to move $200,000 from the R&R fund into the project account, or what, whatever it is.
$1.2 million is what the starting is. We're moving this, and it's going to be at
right. Yeah. And the ending balance is, or the remaining unencumbered balance is X.
So, so on one of the points there, typically we're not moving money from a
fund.
We would just be drawing out of that fund when those expenditures are made. So it's not. It's not that we're, from a fiscal perspective, moving funds from one dedicated fund to another dedicated fund.
Fair enough. But you are, like with the R&R projects we approved, and I'm sorry, I'm getting
no,
go
right
ahead. Go
right. Here.
Yeah.
On the R&R projects that we approved, that's $160,000 there. That money came from the R&R fund, but it came out of the reserve within the R&R fund, I assume.
It's just called the dedicated R&R fund, and we've got a balance of $5 million plus in there or something, okay, right? Yeah, and I think this year's budget's a couple of million, so we have way in excess. But I see
maybe
what your point is.
Maybe we talk offline just a little bit.
Sure.
It's good.
We do that for our assembly meetings. There's a fiscal accountability box on all of the things that just allow us to quickly see it, and we could probably send you a copy of what that even looks like so you can see. I just find it helpful so I know where stuff's coming from and what balances are at.
Yeah,
helps with those questions.
Okay, we'll see what we can do.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
All right, so we do have a motion in regards to adding money, $200,000 to the submarine cable issue. Is there any other comments? Hearing and seeing none. Sharon, would you please call the roll?
Goose?
Yes.
Lynn?
Yes.
Prysanka?
Yes.
Amelon?
Yes.
Sievertson?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much to the staff for putting together such an excellent packet of information for us. That was excellent.
So it is coming on to the hour at 12 o'clock. Do you want to take a do you want to do that, or you want to go through the roadless rule issue first? It's probably fairly short.
Let's just do that one.
Let's do that real quick then. All right. So the next item is an update on the roadless discussion. Trey?
All right, Mr. Chair, thank you. Just keeping the board in the loop on what's going on here. We've been talking about it for a long time. As most of you know, SEPA's taken a stance of supporting a full exemption from our business perspective. It makes sense. It gives us better access to resources to provide energy, and also I think underpins the economic development for the region. So, and we have a long history of being on the record in support of that, of a full exemption through amicus, through comments provided for a forest plan, for EISs, and everything else you can imagine that we've had an opportunity to comment on. So this particular effort is specific to the Alaska, the current EIS that I participated on the governor's public advisory committee there, where we came up with some alternatives. The bookends to that whole process were full exemption and leave it as it is. And so we came up with some options within the middle. That was what our task was. That's run through the process. And the current roadless rule recommendation is for alternative six for the full exemption at this time. And there's a 60-day comment period that's currently open, and I would encourage all three member communities to become engaged on this, and it would be helpful. This is the time to weigh in, if you were ever going to weigh in on something, on your position to either support a particular alternative in some way, shape, or form, and to let them know what the impacts to your community, and if you can get your bodies to come together to file some form of a formal comment, I think that would be beneficial. And of course, this is not a new issue to all of your communities, as you're faced with the challenges that come around with that every day. I recognize some communities may have some challenges coming to that. If your bodies don't support the full exemption, maybe they could maybe lean in on maybe alternative five, which is probably the next best thing to alternative six. So,
what is the end date of the comment period?
December 17th. So
I'm assuming you're going to make a comment for us, alternative six.
For SEPA. Yes, sir. That will be my recommendation, that we proceed with that, and we'll just reiterate the comments that we've made in the past and the reasoning behind them and such.
But Bob, if I might,
yes,
I attended the Alaska Forest Association meeting last week, and I think everybody that comments needs to make substantiated comments, not just I support alternative six, because apparently the day they issued this, the Forest Service got an immediate reply of 30,000 comments. They don't want nothing to happen. Basically shut it down or keep it shut down. So it's up to us that have constituents and economic interest in it to get this rule gone. And personally, it was the forest in the first place, but that's the way the government works. So, but write substantive comments so that they get more than just "I vote no," because that's what they've gotten.
If you can give hard examples of yes, the past where projects have been delayed and become infeasible because of the delay, those are great examples. I mean, a simple example is, look at the Cape Petersburg Intertie. Right, that got delayed, and eventually the project cost just went up so much it made the project infeasible. Yeah. Like the project or not, that's a good example of how something that was fairly cheap at the beginning of the process, due to the delays as a result of the roadless rule, became essentially infeasible after a period of time.
Was your Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Was your ATV or Argo issues, was that related to similar legislation? I know we went four years, I think.
That was more of a AD&R challenge, I think. But those are all related to EISs and the challenges that come around those. You know, and some of this stuff was, these activities were in established corridors to begin with, right? And they have to go through a multi-year, very expensive process to come to a simple solution. It's pretty ridiculous.
Are there helipads?
I think all of it is in some way, if it's in the forest.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think for individual communities, we obviously are facing input from a variety of different interest groups. Tourism related and, you know, utility related. And so I think dealing with this from a multifaceted approach for us is what's going to happen. And so it'd be helpful if we can get some examples from you to put in what our comments are to make sure that we are addressing things from the ability to talk about access for utilities and other things. And then that way we can use our other own local examples to go with that. So if you could provide, I mean, I'm sure you've got some just paragraphs of examples that you could share with us to.
I'll provide our comments.
Okay, great.
And I'll try to get them out at least a few weeks ahead of time. We'll roll up on this deadline pretty quick.
Yeah, understood.
Bob?
Yeah, earlier when we were first on the committee, you had sent out to us some comments you had done, I believe, that were excellent, and I don't have those anymore. Could you we go out again and resend them?
Was that the stand for salmon, though, or was that for the roadless?
Earlier, when you first were on the committee, you had some excellent comments.
I can dig those back up.
Remember I don't have it anymore. That would help.
Yeah, because we put together talking points, and we actually put dollar figures to some of the. Another great example is the STI, right? Cost $2 million a mile to put in. There were actually sections there that we could have put next to a road, right? Just some little nuances there that, you know, the cost of putting a transmission line in by helicopter without a road and long-term maintenance costs versus having a road right next to it. We did put some numbers together to that and some examples.
Yes, yes.
I'll try to dig those up as well.
All right. Anything else in regards to roads? Thank you for that, Dave.
Yep.
So at this time, we'll stand in recess. We have lunch next door.
Yes. Go over to the SEPA office on the left first and grab your sodas and whatnot, and then you'll go into Trey's office and eat lunch.
Okay. So stand in recess.